This is the November 18th climate change law class. Tonight, we're beginning comparative climate change law, seeing how other nations address climate change and seeing how that their approaches compare with the United States. Before we do, I wanted to make a couple of announcements in different areas that we've already talked about. First of which is I wanted to let everyone know that our discussion about the Trans-Pacific Partnership may have been a little premature. In the space of the past week, the partnership has now gotten into serious trouble in the United States. Two separate letters have been sent by congressional delegations, one a group of about 22 members of the Tea Party delegation. Another, a delegation of over 100 House Democrats, have both voiced concerns and objections to the Trans-Pacific Partnership and saying that they will object to giving the president fast-track negotiation status. So stay tuned. I just want to give you a heads up for those of you who are tracking that. That would be the biggest free trade agreement in the world. It would basically give the economic fulcrum for President Obama's desire to pivot to Asia. If it falls to the wayside, it's going to cause some drastic rearranging of priorities and would have some climate change impacts as well. Second, and this is probably just more entertaining, I promised I'd keep you appraised of the Warsaw negotiations, and very interesting things are happening right now. I'm getting a lot of buzz, interest and effort from environmental law professors. As you might expect, many of them have flown over there as part of informal delegations and are now tweeting and emailing and blogging and posting like crazy about it. So as a result, there are things happening under the news stories you may not be hearing about. First of all, I just wanted to sort of give you a quick heads up as to each of the nations that we are going to be studying this week have also now made their initial statements in Warsaw, and they are taking very different approaches to climate change. The United States has basically taken a position that they reject the Kyoto Protocol's approach of having an annex of industrialized nations with substantially greater obligations and then all the non-annex nations who have a lessened responsibility, essentially a dilution of the common but differentiated responsibilities legal principle. The United States has also expressly said in the internal briefing memorandum that got leaked to the press that they reject the idea of any formula that would be used to carve up how much carbon each country can emit from a top-down approach. Instead, the United States wants a bottom-up approach where each nation will voluntarily offer how much carbon mitigation they're willing to undertake. That voluntary offer will be lodged with the UNFCCC Secretariat and then would be subject to transparent evaluation and comment from all the other members. The idea is to have basically a race to the top, give people essentially institutional pressures, frankly, embarrass them almost, to be more stringent, more ambitious in their proposals for reducing their carbon emissions. They also, the United States has said that they do not want to have a $100 billion green fund that is basically supported solely by public expenditures. The United States instead wants to have the bulk of that money come from private investment, which will be catalyzed by strategic public investment. So as you can see, that approach is what you might consider to be a little bit of a softer approach. It's not as much of a compulsory approach. And it is, in a way, continues some of the trajectory that goes back even to the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration. By contrast, China has taken a very strong opening position. And by the way, more so than any other class, this is the one class where you two should feel free to correct and say what you know about China's perspective on climate change and what sorts of climate change domestic laws you have. But in Warsaw, China's taken a position that the trajectory towards an agreement in Paris in 2015 is still within the overall United framework, UNFCC framework, and it is not a basis for a new climate regime. What does that mean? Translation is that it means that they are still going to have common but different trade responsibility, where the developed nations will bear the bulk of responsibility for aggressively reducing their emissions, while the developing nations will set their own nationally appropriate mitigation measures and will receive support from the developed nations, financial and technical, to help achieve them. Essentially an extenuation, a continuation of the Kyoto-type framework. India is taking a very similar position. They're also, as well, aggressively saying that any climate regime is going to have to address intellectual property restrictions on clean energy technology so that they have more access to it without having to pay intellectual property royalties. So you can already see a very clear schism between the United States and some of the growing more large emissions emitters of carbon dioxide. Between those, you also have two other parts I want to flag for you. The European Union has also stated that it has similar position that it shares the United States with two important distinctions. The European Union wants to have a binding international agreement that would provide an enforceable framework for members to submit their carbon reductions. It would not be a matter of voluntarily submitting and then having it subject to review by the group in a transparent fashion. They also would like to have a stronger governance mechanism, which would basically give a role to the United Nations in terms of making sure it coordinates and implements these frameworks. And then last, and perhaps most interestingly, Brazil, which has in prior conferences tried to play the peacemaker and has tried very much to bring the parties together and bridge the developed and developing nations, has put a proposal on that has caused an enormous uproar. Brazil has argued that this conference should end up giving a mandate to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to come up with a methodology to calculate how much greenhouse gas emissions have been emitted by every country going back to the Industrial Revolution. Theory being that will determine who is responsible for current levels of atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations, and then responsibility for those could be apportioned appropriately, and how we spread the remaining amount of carbon that we can emit without exceeding the 2 degrees Celsius threshold can be apportioned fairly. In other words, think about this. Essentially, there is a trillion-ton carbon pie. Once this trillion tons has been emitted into the atmosphere, we are irrevocably committed to disruptive, dangerous climate change. A large portion of that trillion-ton slug has already been emitted. So essentially, two things. It means that we're going to have to figure out how to allocate the remaining wedge that could still be emitted. And the Brazilian proposal lays the groundwork for perhaps a fault-based allocation. And second, it means that a lot of that carbon will be left in the ground. We will not be able to pull out coal, oil, other fossil fuels without exceeding the trillion-ton cap. That's actually led to shareholder proposals to revalue assets held by corporations, which are based on petroleum and hydrocarbon reserves. But point being, Brazil has now urged that this discussion take place within the formal confines of the UNFCCC Conference of Parties. And it's causing an enormous uproar. So, as you can see, we've got a spectrum, an interesting range of different positions. What I wanted to do is first apprise you of that, but second, and this is probably the thing I want to flag for you, keep in mind the positions these nations are taking at the United Nations do not necessarily reflect their domestic approaches to climate change. You may find that some of the nations that are most aggressive internationally are actually the ones that are taking some of the least action at home, and vice versa. And in particular, you may find that China is an interesting demonstration of this. Second thing I wanted to flag for you, general topic, is you may have been seeing loss and damage as a legal concept coming out of Warsaw. It was on the front page of the Sunday Times lead article. I'm not sure how many of you may have saw it, but since it was up, I felt like we needed to at least talk about it in class. The idea behind this concept of loss and damage is that the UN Framework Convention and subsequent protocols should expressly provide a mechanism to compensate nations that are suffering loss and damage due to climate change. The loss and damage is for damages due to climate events that cannot be adapted to and which mitigation cannot stop. This is not an additional compensation mechanism. It's actually designed to be a third tier. You'd have mitigation, adaptation, and then loss and damages as a third major component of the UN framework. There's been a proposal to have this discussed in Warsaw and then incorporated formally and the 2015 agreement in Paris. I will pause here and just sort of float a trial balloon for you all. What do you think the United States' response is to the concept of including loss and damage in the UN Framework Convention discussions? No, no. Even Lisa is saying, no. Okay. Yes, you're absolutely correct. The United States is strongly, viscerally opposed to this particular proposal.
What was the third one? Mitigation, loss, and damage.
Mitigation, adaptation, and loss and damages. Matter of fact, the United States has resisted even discussing the concept. The United States, in an internal briefing memo that was leaked to the press, basically took the position, and we're discussing what happened in Warsaw and the big debate that was on the front page of the New York Times on Sunday. Essentially, the United States would like to subsume their entire concept of loss and damages within the existing adaptation framework. Essentially make it a small item within a larger array of things that countries can do to adapt. So why isn't the front page of the New York Times? Well, it turns out that the G77 group and China have threatened a walkout. Essentially, according to, again, this is unofficial. It's also being reported in certain newspapers, but not in the US press yet, apparently. But apparently, this G77 and China group has threatened, I use with some consideration, that's a precise term, that they believe the Warsaw Conference must have a deliverable, a formal discussion item on loss and damages, and that it should be formally included in the items to be presented in Paris for the 2015 treaty. They have said that they will withhold approval and discussion of other items from Warsaw unless this issue is included. So as a result, while this has been an issue that's been swept under the rug, frankly, in prior meetings, it is squarely in the center of discussion. It is getting the highest level of attention from the Secretariat, and it's becoming essentially a test case on the ability of the developed nations to keep a particular item like this, which is from inclusion in the formal agenda for discussion. Just so I can make sure I'm being fair, the United States is not opposing this concept because of concerns about the liability of the United States directly. Their position is that this framework is counterproductive, that putting loss and discussion, damages discussions and liability discussions will polarize the framework, will make it very difficult to reach any type of agreement, consensus, and that effectively will poison the well. By contrast, in particular, small island nation states, developing nations that are vulnerable to climate change, are frankly galvanized by Typhoon Haiyan, the incredible damage the Philippines have suffered, and that, frankly, every conference for the past 3 years has begun with an acknowledgement of a large climate event that might be influenced by climate change. So things are coming to a head. Now, with that in mind, I want to make sure we have time for our comparative law discussion. I will float for you something to think about. Is there a legal reason why the United States and other developed nations, the Annex I nations, be willing to accept loss and damages as a formal element of the UN Framework Convention? What does it get you to agree to sign up to that mechanism? And the beauty of this is, since there's no reading on it, there's no way you can have a right or wrong answer. This is just your native intelligence here. You were going to say something.
I was thinking maybe, I don't know if it would or wouldn't, but maybe it could provide you some protection against like tort liability or like from nuisance claims, and if you've already got this overriding mechanism to award damages.
Mm-hmm. No, actually, flesh that out. Remember, we've talked about fact that the small island nation states are preparing a claim that would go to for an advisory opinion at the International Court of Justice. Part of that claim is going to be a declaration of liability of the developed nations, as well as a request of responsibility for them to deal with damages these nations are suffering going forward. To a certain extent, it reminds like the Connecticut versus American Electric Power Supreme Court decision. Essentially, you can preempt, I don't want to use that term, you can essentially proactively take charge of the issue by having an international treaty framework which will displace the customary international law framework that would be before the International Court of Justice. The other is, remember, the United States has already signed up to the $100 billion climate fund. To the extent that that fund is going to be addressing some of the exact same sorts of things that the loss and damages basket would cover, you're not really necessarily signing up for a large additional liability. So I throw this out for you to think about. This may sound like an ultimate non-starter for the United States' position, but it might actually ultimately end up being a bargaining chip, especially as we get closer to Paris, and especially if this issue threatens to torpedo the entire discussion. So with that, I'll pause. So any other questions or thoughts?
Well, that concept, it's creating largely a group license so that when devastation occurs somewhere, everybody pitches in. So would we domestically also see aggregate income from other people to fix New Orleans, to fix Sandy, to fix all of these things, is what you're saying? Instead of it being our domestic money fixing ourselves, we would be dipping into other people's.
That's a delightful idea, but I don't think that that's what's being discussed.
But I mean, if everybody's signing on, why is it that when a tornado tears through Illinois and wipes out a community not familiar with it, we're not looking at China, we're not looking at whatever, but every time there's a flood across a small island nation, it's the oil and gas companies in the United States?
Because the premise of the fund, loss and damages, is that it's targeting nations that lack the capacity to respond to damages caused by climate change. So essentially, the United States would be put in a position of saying that it lacks the capacity to respond to a Katrina. It lacks the capacity to deal with a tornado event that might be climate-induced. So, you know.
Wouldn't the argument be that we reap the reward for having those oil companies based in the United States with the economic benefit of having a lot of these industrialized companies here, but we don't have to pay for their consequences?
Well, again, I'm taking a bit of a leap of faith by describing something that's still being written.
Yeah.
But the way it's been described is that it actually takes fault and causation out of the equation.
Yeah.
All it cares about is whether or not the loss and damage can be attributed to climate change.
But I mean, the idea that climate change is a global problem, and I guess this is more towards your point, that, you know, if you can't deal with climate change, then chances are that you're not reaping the reward that the industrialization that might cause it.
That's not the initial conversation, is that he's saying there's so many nations are signing on to something to largely either cap or provide some contribution from each state, each nation state that is the main placeholder, the main players are going to create this fund to help all these nations that can't respond. And so my discussion is, why wouldn't that also throw money back at ourselves out of that fund from all these other nations? I understand the premise is to worry about every island, but we spend so much domestically on repair of our own infrastructure.
And I will say, from a purely legal and even almost from a mathematical viewpoint, that makes perfect intuitive sense. But the entire premise of this is effectively wealth transfer, and I'd say that not as a pejorative term. But the idea that there's a certain collection of nations that lack the capacity, this framework's designed to help them respond. And I think the almost definitional premise of it is that developed nations that have benefited from emitting carbon during the Industrial Revolution, but basically have the capacity. Now, given you what you've said, you could have a nation that theoretically has fallen on hard times or has been hit by a truly mega disaster. So that really has done something that just goes beyond the pale. I don't think people are talking about that. A super Katrina, a super Sandy, that really something even the United States can't respond to. I think this fund is really designed to deal with the G77 and less developed nations.
So is it essentially like super fund for the global, a global super fund, where you don't know necessarily where fault lies, but there's a pool of money to. It's not exactly like Superfund.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's like parts of Superfund. Right. It is in the sense of that it does create a pool of money that's available to respond to an environmental emergency. The difference is with Superfund is the CERCLA statute creates a broad basket of liability to help replenish that fund that is attributable to past actions. There's no similar liability mechanism here. The nations have to agree to to basically put in the money that'd be required for loss and damages. And by the way, they're not linking the $100 billion fund to loss and damages. This current proposal keeps it separate. I'm just pointing out from the United States perspective, they can link the two effectively. They might get the benefit of a legal resolution without additional whole lot of cost.
I guess I don't know much about how Superfund has worked out, but has it been a good...
There is no more fund associated with Superfund, correct?
This sounds like the voice of bitter experience over here.
There's no more money in CERCLA. There's just liability now.
Actually, there is money. There's just no Superfund tax to replenish the fund. So what happens is every year, Congress has to reallocate funds to it from general revenue. So Congress frequently will starve the program if they're unhappy with EPA. But you know, I think perhaps the question, did it work, could be captured a different way. Superfund has been effective at getting certain sites cleaned up. The question is whether it was the best way to go about it. Some reports have shown that certain sites, up to 80% of the cost, have been spent on litigation.
Good for us.
I know. I'm not objecting. You know, some of us have had a very long and happy career of Superfund sites.
2 years I should volunteer in order to get a job in the government. So right now,
The other thing I think with the Superfund is that it's just basically expensive and slow, even apart from litigation. You know, some sites, just personal experience, there's some sites that I personally worked on for over 20 years. Just take, from an engineer's perspective, that's probably appalling, because usually you can clean up something like this if you just sort of cut to the chase, within space of maybe 4 or 5 years at most. But I don't think in any way that the loss and damage fund is meant to be a super fund. It's more a sense of basically a way to provide compensation to nations that have suffered loss and damage. Notice it doesn't have to be linked to restoring the lost, damaged assets. It's not like Superfund where you're actually putting the money back into the contaminated ground.
I would just think all you have is $100 billion to deal with communities being destroyed by these massive storms. I think you'd run out of money pretty quickly. I mean, I don't know what the cost has been estimated for Philippines, but wiped out.
As my father loves to say, you're preaching to the choir. I will simply say it's $100 billion annually. It's okay. Not a one-time assessment.
Okay. All right, that's a little
good. So when it comes to a lot of what you're saying here is that that these things can be incredibly expensive, and you'll put a lot of money into fixing. Does the debate about the whole, with Katrina, do we rebuild New Orleans exactly where it is, where it's going to eventually be flooded no matter what happens? I mean, what happens when these nation states, do we spend a lot of money rebuilding Palau every single time a storm comes through if in 10 years Palau's not going to be there anyway? I mean, who decides adaptation versus mitigation with this $100 billion?
Short answer is unclear. I mean, the $100 billion has been set up as a fund. The actual mechanism for disbursement is still being worked on, mainly because the fund's not yet been fully filled up yet.
I assume somebody's thinking about it already.
Were you going to say something? Okay, that's all right. You have to be careful. Whenever you scratch your head, I'm immediately going to pounce and think you're asking a question. But there is no pick and choose mechanism currently for the $100 billion fund, but it's meant to be designed to assist with nations to transition to lower carbon energy sources and to adapt. Second, my strong expectation is that it's going to be only able to work as if national sovereignty is preserved for choices on how to spend the funds once they get them. Having the UN say you've got to spend your money this way is a recipe for disaster. And that's one of the key points in Warsaw. The developed nations want a bigger say in how that money gets spent. And also, again, maybe I'll double check this to make sure, but my recollection is the way those documents are written, you don't have to spend your money rebuilding something that's lost.
There's only so many times you can rebuild huts in the Philippines. Because, if the bigger issue of that, large storms are going to come through every year, they're just going to wash those huts away every year.
Although, in fairness, It wasn't huts in the Philippines. It was an actual city of about 250,000 people.
Yes, no, I know that there are actual buildings, but you know, you'll see the pictures and it'll be like one actual building that maybe doesn't have roof, but then like all the smaller structures are gone.
Well, for those of you who are interested, sort of the next generation of climate change law, and this will probably be a topic the next time I teach this, assuming they'll let me teach this class again, climate triage. Essentially, at what point do you stop trying to save things that are irrevocably committed to basically passing away? That includes things like certain types of dangerous species that you basically know you cannot save because the climate change is at this point irrevocably committed to a point that they cannot survive. Island nations that are going to disappear beneath the waves, but no matter what you do. You can try and build them, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to perpetually make sure their existence. You know, glacier preservation, which frankly, no matter what you do, at some point they're going to be gone. That idea of where to sort of decide, you know, to cut your losses, that law is currently being designed and written right now. And what sort of liability associates with that conscious decision to let things go. So I'm sorry, I feel like I've kind of wandered off into philosophy there. But that's sort of get to your point?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we spent $14 billion on New Orleans, if you didn't know what that would be cost. We've already rebuilt $14 billion domestically. Mm-hmm. So of your $100 billion we talk about, the domestic side is what I can't. That's insane to me.
All right. Well. I'll sort of make a quick. I'm sorry. By the way, no, I'm glad you survived the trip over here.
No, that's my question.
No,
I was just simply going to say, it's just. I should press stop on the record here. But my wife actually represents a company that has refinery assets south of New Orleans, and it's interesting that the flood defenses they're constructing right now, immediately to the south of them, $100,000+ homes are being constructed. Essentially, you know, despite all the money we're putting in there, we're still setting ourselves up for another massive climate hit at some point if the hurricane comes back in. And I'll also say, you know, take a look at West Galveston. You know, you think Ike would have addressed some of this?
I don't know if this question was already answered, but what's preventing the developed nations or the ones that are accused of being the high polluters of greenhouse gases to not formalize any of the agreements that are going on, because they are going to be held liable, they have to produce funds. I mean, we've had issues with these nations with following certain policies. They didn't want to be held liable under the Kyoto. So what's preventing them now from saying, I don't want to be part of that?
Well, let me first acknowledge you've got the perfect insight as to what the posture of the United States was in the 1990s. Remember, George W. Bush withdrew from Kyoto, said the United States not only would not ratify it, we're going to magically take our signature back off the paper, and refused to participate other than on a voluntary basis with any kind of climate change efforts. Having said that, we're in a different world now. You know, why would the United States now want to be part of a treaty framework that's going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, if it may potentially face liability under?
We talked about these nations wanting to have a say, wanting to be at the table rather than, but just looking at international law itself, that is not really binding if you don't sign a document. I mean.
Well, but treaties do have consequences. You do have potential liabilities for violating treaties, even if it has to take place in an international arbitral or a decisional body that you have to exceed jurisdiction to. But I was thinking, to a certain extent, we, the United States, may get a benefit, even if there's some risk associated with it, from signing on to an international treaty if other nations are stepping up to the plate as well. Keep in mind, we're not the number one emitter anymore. Keep in mind, we have probably as much climate exposure as almost any other nation because we have so much vulnerable coastal assets. We have a stake in the climate change game, and to a certain extent, basically saying, we don't like your treaty, we're going home, essentially leaves the field to the rest of the nation, community of nations, and it may come up with a way that doesn't help us and actually make things worse for us. Joanne?
Well, I think that
I was going to say, I mean, just I know it sounds anti-cynical, but you might actually just want to fix.
That's a delightful term, but go ahead.
Because I know every time anyone says anything, it's always cynical, because that's sort of, it's a cynical kind of field, but it could just be that we want to solve climate change. I mean.
Well, it is sort of an existential question there.
There is like sort of a benefit to all this treaty signing, because there's a benefit to stopping or at least slowing climate change.
Yeah, but the truth is, we can always at least do our part, regardless of whether we sign a treaty. And that's sort of our position
before. But there's always a benefit that when you sign, it promotes other people signing. I mean, there's world politics like there.
Exactly. And I think that's why the United States has basically been stepping up to the plate to try. One of the things I probably should have stressed, the key thing the United States envoy has said that they're going to walk in there and assure everybody, is the United States believes strongly that there will be a binding international treaty in 2015 that will apply to all nations. This will not be a Kyoto two-tier approach. The United States wants it, it's going to apply to everybody. From that perspective, your question cuts to the heart of the matter, but it also explains why the United States would put itself into the mix. And to a certain extent, it gives us the ability to have some say as to how other nations are reducing their greenhouse gas emissions in a way that actually protects our interests too. That was a long answer. Does that get to your question? But actually, that might also be a bit of a nice transition as well, unless folks have more questions about Warsaw at this point. But the differing stakes, the different approaches of different nations in the UN Framework Convention discussions, in a way, gets paralleled on the domestic level. And what I want to do is just briefly walk through three nations tonight, and then set the stage for Wednesday when Secretary Wiggins will talk about Britain and the European Union. What I'm going to talk about tonight is China, Brazil, and then just as a bit of a coda, India, but from the strictly common law perspective. Just sort of setting out the big picture, a couple of things. First of all, not every nation obviously is taking a similar approach domestically to climate change. If I had to sort of give you some grounding, if you had a spectrum of most active nations, the most active, proactive group that's dealing with climate change right now on the domestic level would probably be the European Union. The European Union has stepped up and has acceded to some fairly groundbreaking commitments, and I'll talk about those in a little bit. And then, you know, the other of the spectrum, frankly, for a long time, had been the United States in terms of resisting participation in the international efforts, and that its domestic program reflected that unwillingness to cooperate. You'll notice that this picture is changing. The EU is moving a little bit more towards the center, and so is the United States. That big picture reflects some changing realities, and your book, sadly, is behind the curve. And I'm sorry, this is one of the most recent books out there, but unfortunately, the data just moves so quickly. You know, the table that it lists showing the emissions from nations is dated 2005. Even if you go to 2010, you'll see that there are some dramatic shifts in increased emissions from developing nations that are quickly industrializing. China, in particular now, people tend to think of China as being ahead of the United States. I don't think it's really caught on just how much China is ahead of the United States in terms of emissions. China now emits more greenhouse gases than the United States and Canada combined. If you take a look at the nations that have significant increases in CO2 emissions, all of them have been in developing nations. Developed nations have shown a decrease generally in emissions profiles, with some specific exceptions, which I'll come back to in a minute, but particularly with Canada and Japan. And despite that, you have to acknowledge the reality that the per capita emissions is still heavily weighted towards the developed world. China's, for example, per capita emissions are anywhere, I think, about a quarter of what you would see from a typical per capita emissions from the United States. So with that in mind, we have to keep that the grand picture showing that how nations deal domestically with greenhouse gas emissions has an enormous impact, probably even more than the international treaty framework in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions that affect the United States. So with that in mind, I'll go ahead and go straight to discussion of China, and then we'll talk a little bit about Brazil. If we have time at the end, I'll talk a little bit about the European Union. China I'm going to start at a high level. At this point, I'm tiptoeing, because please correct me as I'm going along. But no. I want to be respectful. The place to start is acknowledging the differences in the way the Chinese political system is structured compared to the United States. As opposed to a federal system in the United States with a division of power between coordinate branches of government, China instead resides virtually all sovereign power in the National People's Congress. The National People's Congress is not like our Congress in terms of operation and size. It includes over 2,000 delegates, for example. Bless you. It also does not meet continuously. But it is the body that basically makes the fundamental ultimate decisions ultimately. Now, that's the political structure. In reality, of course, that is too large and unwieldy a body to be able to make day-to-day important strategic decisions. So as a result, smaller bodies within that structure make the other calls. And in particular, probably the most important would be the Standing Committee of the Politburo of the Chinese Communist Party. Within that framework, the State Council, which is a council consisting of heads of various bodies and agencies within the Chinese government, effectively becomes the most important lawmaking institution. You may pause now and hit the United States. The Americans' question would be, where does the Chinese Supreme People's Court fit into this? Here's the main difference. It reports to Congress. Remember, that is the ultimate source of sovereignty in the nation. So while it does provide judicial body, decision-making authority, it is in the civil code tradition. Its decisions are not deemed to be law. At most, they're deemed to be persuasive and influential, and their decisions are reported back and subject to override by the people's Congress. So as you can see, the ability of the Chinese government to respond swiftly and to have policy dictates that get implemented throughout the entire nation is actually vastly faster. I'm trying to think of the best way to put it. I won't say superior, but it certainly gives them the ability to move with greater speed and greater authority than the negotiations and the split authority that you might see in the United States or other types of represented democracies. That has influenced the way China has approached climate change. So I'll pause right there. Any questions about that? The book goes into some history as to how the political structure has evolved, but I just want to make sure that's where the current posture of things are. And I also welcome any questions or comments or suggestions you guys might have. No?
What are you saying?
Okay, thank you. Feel free to go if I missed any things here. So what does that mean for climate change? Well, climate change, and again, I'm going to perhaps do injustice to the rich nuance of the development here, but essentially it was viewed as an important issue for China in terms of developing its environmental and scientific reputational authority in the International Community of Nations, but it didn't really influence internal policy in China until climate change began to be viewed as an energy issue. As a result, right now, the Chinese government has a five-year plan. We are now in the 12th five-year plan. And that five-year plan has now viewed climate change as an important energy security foundational issue for the Chinese people. Given the increased accelerated economic growth has led to energy demands that it will quickly have already made China into a major oil importer, it has basically become a matter of vital security, national interest for China to reduce its energy demands, to increase its energy efficiency, and basically make itself more independent on the energy front. So as a result, China actually has some very aggressive goals. Their latest five-year plan specifically says that they're going to reduce their energy consumption by 15% to 27%. Compare that to the United States, where most of our energy reduction has been due to economic recession. Most of our emission reductions have been due to the surplus of natural gas that we've developed. China has also, because of this energy security issue, strongly emphasized a convergence of multiple technologies that are not rooted in fossil fuels. So the five-year plan specifically emphasizes wind, hydropower, and clean tech. The five-year plan is going to specifically reduce the intensity of carbon emissions from the energy that is going to still be used. So essentially, this confluence of goals is having a very specific effect in that China, after having been building a new coal-fired power plant in the space of about one a week for the past several, almost past decade, is now starting to shut down older, less efficient coal-fired power plants. And the newer plants are now, they're exploring alternative technologies to try and reduce carbon emissions from them. Right now, at Copenhagen, China committed, again in the sort of loose and formal Copenhagen Accord status, to a 45% reduction in national carbon intensity levels. And that could equal, now notice it's carbon intensity, that's not emissions. So if you reduce intensity but increase energy production, you can still, under the way that they phrased it, have a 200% increase in emissions from China. But right now, the way the most likely trajectory is they're going to reduce emissions 15% based on that commitment alone. Because of this, again, confluence of goals, China is also restructuring which strategic industries it's investing in, moving away from metallurgical operations, moving away from heavy intensive energy-based operations. The move to manufacturing helped reduce the carbon profile. There's a continuing move now to higher tech and service industries, which will also continue to reduce their carbon profile. So essentially, I'm going to suggest to you that the image you might get in the popular press about China is dead wrong. China may be playing a pretty aggressive game with the UN Framework Convention negotiations in Warsaw in the Conference of Parties. But if you look at what they're doing internally, for reasons that are not necessarily rooted in environmental concerns, although China clearly has very strong environmental concerns outside of climate change issues, because of energy security, because of economic development concerns, they actually have probably one of the most aggressive climate change programs in the world. It just doesn't get much attention. It doesn't get much play. That also, remember, is a goal set by the National Party. While China does not have a formal federalism system, it still has to be implemented in the local level. And China has had difficulty with environmental obligations being translated into effective environmental enforcement. But because of this economic convergence, it's actually giving a strong impetus to actual have performance of these climate change goals. So China may not necessarily be what you think. And that's why I wanted to pause and make sure we kind of got that picture in. You can really misjudge China based on its international posture, but if you take a look, right now they're just beginning the work on their 13th five-year plan, and it's projected their goals will be even more aggressive the next go-around. That may raise the interesting question, which is, how does the United States stack up against that? I'll simply say, bless you. You're still not quite there yet.
Luckily, everyone else seems to be getting it, so I still
want to. You have to rephrase that a little bit. It's great. Everyone else is getting sick, too. Point being, in the past, frankly, I could get into a very heated debate with the class about the fact that the United States, frankly, wasn't putting nearly the amount of effort onto the table as China was in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Once again, we're starting to move towards the center of the spectrum, though. With the effort right now to try and impose PSD requirements to actually have an NSPS for new coal-fired plants that will translate to existing coal-fired power plants, we're starting to see an actual translation to legal obligation. But notice it's all administrative. We do not have a five-year plan. I'm not suggesting we do, but we don't have the same sort of legal mandatory framework that translates into a compulsory impetus to take action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So with that, I'll pause. Any questions about China then, or how it might compare to the United States before I move into Brazil? I also, and I keep coming back to you, but it's such a rare treat to have two environmental professors from China monitoring the class. If you had any thoughts or comments you want to offer, mean, I've kind of, would you agree with what I've said about China's approach to climate change?
Yes.
And I would agree with you. I didn't interrupt, please.
But like you said, maybe the awareness is not enough. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Everything is so complicated.
That's what makes it so much fun. I didn't know that.
I don't know. Even clothes, I buy clothes here cheaper than in China.
That's maybe astonishing. Is that because of tariffs or?
Tariffs, but okay. The other thing is technology, especially for industry like car manufacturing.
So that's because the cars are not made in China?
They are made in China, but just because we don't have that kind of high technology, so that means no competition in the market, so they don't need to adopt the high technology.
That's right.
Okay. So in the international economic field, some people support this view. Developed countries should force the companies that are investing in the developing countries adopt the home country technology.
If a United States corporation wanted to invest and build a facility in China, it would have to meet U.S. environmental standards,
right,
in China.
The home state, right,
right.
Home state.
Standard. Then they wouldn't go to China.
Yeah.
But they go to China to avoid.
Considering the labor force and the other costs still lower, you know, in China, so that doesn't match so.
Well, and.
Measure so much, but I don't know why
the situation may be changing.
It's changing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Some developing countries don't want to do that, to force the transnational companies to apply higher environmental standards because they are afraid that the company don't want to invest.
But I will simply say, while that discussion is happening in China, in the United States and other nations, a lot of the large multinational corporations have basically concluded for their own individual reasons that they want to have the same standards applied throughout their corporation, no matter where their operations are, China, Africa, anywhere else in Asia. For multiple reasons, not least of which is liability. It's a terrible, terrible factual scenario when you protect your workers in one nation from a risk and leave them exposed in another one and people get injured or killed. It also is important in terms of sometimes those standards make economic sense. The energy efficiency will save you money no matter what nation you're in. So the same discussion in China that would require companies like Walmart to meet their U.S. standards
Walmart has already decided what they call supply chain environmental standards, where they're requiring all their suppliers anywhere in the world to meet their standards, which are functionally close to U.S. standards. I also wanted to give more credit where credit's due. Even though cars may cost more in China, and there might be a technology gap to a little extent, China, though, is probably ahead of the United States in mandating mileage efficiency from cars. How many miles per gallon of gasoline you can get, or miles per liter. You had standards imposed on automobiles in China that required them to be much more efficient than the United States did. And we are only just now starting to catch up to your standards. The other is China's actually also been an experiment with having carbon trading, actual carbon markets within certain provinces and cities. They don't have a national market yet, but the theory is that the next five-year plan will use the experiences from these local markets to look at larger markets. That's my understanding. You could.
I think the governments are facing a very great pressure from the international field and domestically.
Mm-hmm.
Because individuals are more aware of environmental protection and climate change.
One other point I'll make is that China actually has also benefited from the Clean Development Mechanism and the Kyoto Protocol. A lot of the projects financed by European corporations have been in China to generate offset credits, certified emission unit reduction. So you'll notice, though, the discussion of China's approach is driven by some of the same factors that drive U.S. approach, namely industrialized production of goods. Our emissions come from consumption of fossil fuels. As a result, our policies in some way, while they have different emphasis and reflect different local realities, tend to focus on the same ways to reduce emissions. Brazil's totally different. The source of their greenhouse gases is not necessarily production, industrial manufacturing, and fossil fuel consumption. It's instead in deforestation. So their climate change law is radically different from China or the United States, which is interesting because in a lot of ways, Brazil's political structure is much closer to the U.S. structure than China's is. Brazil actually has a federal elected democracy. It actually has states. It actually has a similar division of power among branches. But because its greenhouse gas issues are actually driven by deforestation and the fact that Brazil actually has over half of the Earth's remaining rainforest, most of its emissions, 75% of them, are driven by deforestation. That means its laws focus heavily on protecting rainforest. Brazil was the first developing nation to limit deforestation by essentially taking advantage of the RED program, R-E-D-D, which targets creating tradable credits and benefits for preventing deforestation and for reforesting areas. So as a result, Brazil had a fairly aggressive law that was frankly not being enforced. They were losing rainforest to essentially be the same square acreage as New Jersey every year. Basically gone. It would be turned into pasture or converted into monocrops, particular soybean, or being used for grazing cattle. That rate has now been reduced substantially because of a new aggressive enforcement program that Brazil's implemented, essentially using satellite tracking, essentially requiring owners to maintain coverage of their lands that are rainforests of at least 50, but up to 80%. And also basically having a system that requires certification that you're complying with the Brazilian forestation maintenance requirements. That means effectively that Brazil, targeting only reforestation and deforestation, has set targets of greenhouse gas emissions that actually are pretty aggressive. They're looking at reductions of up to 38%. Based on just forestry management.
interesting since Brazil is actually one of the fastest growing greenhouse gas emitters. It's one of the most rapidly industrializing countries. But because it sinks of greenhouse gases, because its sources of greenhouse gas emissions are rooted in a completely different source than ours, its approach, which is totally valid domestically and totally valid within the UN Framework Convention, makes a lot of sense for them. So once again, you may not hear much about Brazil being a leader in climate change. It is. It's just in a way that you may not be thinking about. And frankly, from their perspective, they're viewing it as a smart financial investment to preserve the rainforest. I'll pause there. Any questions about Brazil? Which is, I have to say, in my mind, when I've heard today about Brazil's position in the Warsaw discussions about assigning the IPCC to come up with a total, trillion ton carbon allocation for methodology, I'm not quite sure how the deforestation fits in with that, whether or not that would count against their credit. So it might be something to watch, and it might explain some of the things that they're doing. All right, then, with the time remaining, let me then just briefly talk about India. And actually, I'm not going to talk about the Indian climate change statutes, which actually, in many ways, parallels to the ones we've already talked about with China. What I want to talk about is the fact that India actually is, in many ways, an interesting parallel to the United States when you look at the law. Remember, India actually has a common law system. Its courts are predicated from base when it was a British protectorate. Its entire court systems are conducted in English. They are open to the public, and they are rooted in English common law. As part of that process, India has its own public nuisance and tort law traditions. There is one striking development in India that the United States and Britain do not adopt, called public interest litigation. And I'll pause here because I always worry I'm telling you folks things about you already know. Have y'all been exposed or talked about public interest litigation in any of your other classes? Okay. Picture class action lawsuits on steroids. Public interest litigation is rooted in constitutional, bless you, constitutional guarantees, right to basically a right to due process, but also a right to liberty. In India, that basically allows a certain type of lawsuit to be brought on behalf of the poor and dispossessed. It is essentially allows lawsuits to target large-scale activity that infringes on this constitutional right to due process and liberty, which has been interpreted to include what you might even call penumbral rights to a clean environment. It allows representatives to file lawsuits on behalf, for example, of all the slum dwellers of Calcutta to argue that they're being forced to live in habitation that is environmentally unsafe. It allows someone to file a lawsuit against all of the industries that discharge into the particular river system, claiming that that impairs the users of the waters for users downstream. Notice it doesn't require the users to file. It doesn't require the downstream water users to file. It doesn't require the slum dwellers to file. It allows instead, under public interest litigation, to have a representative file on their behalf. As a result, there are extremely accomplished, just incredible lawyers who have a job in India, who basically have undertaken the task of India of targeting strategic public interest litigation designed to actually change fundamental aspects of Indian economy and society that pose threats to these constitutional rights. The other thing about these lawsuits, notice that even though they're rooted in English traditions, they don't hit political question objections. Because this particular guarantee is written into the Constitution, the Indian courts have deemed that these types of issues can be squarely addressed by the court system. The other thing is that they provide direct original jurisdiction to the Indian Supreme Court. And the Indian Supreme Court has not been shy about issuing judicial relief to direct and compel executive branch agencies to undertake discretionary action. So, for example, public interest litigation has been used to compel emission reductions from taxi fleets to protect the Taj Mahal. They've been used to shut down swaths of tanneries that have been polluting the Ganges River. They have been used to particularly target illegal foresting activity. All of this activity has led to a growing environmental presence in the Indian dockets that has now recently caused them to create a new court called the National Green Tribunal. Public interest litigation is not required to go to that tribunal, but the tribunal theoretically is going to help resolve some of these environmental issues so that the need for public interest litigation in the Supreme Court can be reduced. Here's the question. This type of litigation has been enormously, spectacularly effective. No one has filed a claim for climate change. There have been no climate nuisance lawsuits filed in India. I checked this morning, all the sources I found, nothing. The question on everyone's mind right now is not why, but when. The way the system is set up, it is uniquely well positioned, if you could find the right test case, to force the Indian government to take more aggressive steps to deal with climate change. The real question is, essentially, that type of lawsuit would have a cost associated with it of shifting resources that might be dedicated to protecting public interest in one sphere to deal with climate change that might have immediate beneficial effects to the Indian poor. So picking the right place to put the pressure might be the issue. But I just wanted to sort of flag for you guys, if you're thinking about it, just because the United States has had public nuisance lawsuits hit the shoals of federal jurisdictional requirements and displacement preemption doesn't mean that there's not possibility of similar very large-scale litigation taking place in other nations. I was in New Delhi about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago actually, and you know, basically this issue is under active discussion, and we'll probably be back in New Delhi next spring to revisit it again. So I'll pause with that. Any questions about Indian common law approaches on climate change and what might be happening? You guys are quiet tonight. All right, then as a final point, let me just briefly touch on EU, and that way you'll have the vocabulary for talking about the UK on Wednesday with Secretary Wiggins. Essentially, the EU, European Union approach, is supranational. Those of you are, I'm sure, all aware that the European Union is essentially a governing body that's designed to closely integrate the disparate economies and political structures of all the European nations. It includes 27 member states. They respond and deal with the European Council, with a European Parliament, and the European Commission acting as an executive agency. The European Union has been probably one of the most proactive governmental bodies on pursuing and implementing proactive greenhouse gas emissions by developed nations. The EU's memberships has signed, for example, the Kyoto Protocol. They went forward under the Kyoto Protocol with setting up a multinational greenhouse gas trading system. They've also incorporated directly the precautionary principle in their implementation of some of these requirements. And as a result, they have had some notable accomplishments. They've brought in 11,500 major stationary sources under the trading system. And they've also had a 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions in the European Union. Question, of course, is how much of that might be attributable to other sources, things like, for example, the collapse of the Eastern European bloc's economies after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And we've talked about the Russian hot gas problem. But bottom line, I want to let you know that the UK initiative, the legislation that they've implemented, takes place within this larger framework against the backdrop of the European Union. And while the UK's relationship with the European Union is a little problematic in many respects and it's not fully integrated, it does drive some of their commitments to climate change. And the United Kingdom has signed protocols directly in its own right as part of that. So anyway, that's a very high-level, fast review, but I just want to sort of give you a sense that the EU, if anything, is providing a lot of the impetus for some of the action that you might be seeing for the United Kingdom. Any questions about that or thoughts? Okay. Then with that, I'm sorely tempted to try and squeeze in Canada, but I'll simply say, remember, Canada is withdrawn from the Kyoto Protocol. they basically concluded they could not possibly meet their emission reductions. That doesn't mean that they still don't have efforts to try and reduce greenhouse gases in their own local trading systems, but you know, despite the fact we're talking about the UK, I just want to sort of keep in mind that other nations, also in the British political tradition, are taking a different path.
Did you see the EEA report? They just said that the Canadian oil sands is not a large contributor to global warming.
I'd love to see that.
I think that was just released yesterday or something, that its percentage is far overestimated.
It might be overestimated, but every account I've seen so far does peg them as a major source. And I guess, along with Canada, I'll simply note, Australia is in the same basket as well. They have the highest per capita greenhouse gas emissions of any nation, in, any major nation in the world, and they're also withdrawing from the Kyoto Protocol framework, and have also been one of the strongest recalcitrants in some of the negotiations taking place currently right now in Warsaw. Final note as well, one other nation is withdrawing from Kyoto, Japan. And Japan has actually decided that they cannot meet their requirements without nuclear power, and because of Fukushima, they cannot satisfy their commitment to greenhouse gas emission reductions on the same pace, and they're taking a lot of heat in Warsaw right now because of it. All right, so I feel like kind of skipped around a lot. Any questions about how other nations are approaching climate change compared with the United States? And any questions about Secretary Wiggins before he comes here on Wednesday? Just to let you know, I have extended an open invitation to the environmental law classes and the environment and energy law societies to come listen. So just give you a quick heads up, the room may have a lot of folks in it. You might want to get here if you can a little bit early to make sure you have a seat. Seems unlikely, but you never can tell. And with that, that is the class. Last chance. We're off the record.